Radio EcoShock.
As climate disasters ramp up, big powers and agencies push for more biofuels as a green answer. But does the math of emission savings hold up? What if biofuels are a mistake, leading to even more emissions and warming? Our guest, Kian Delaney, brings the latest. Kian is campaign coordinator on energy for the European Federation of NGOs called TNE, Transport and Environment. From Brussels, Kian Delaney, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, delighted to be here.
Why did your group, Transport and Environment, release a new briefing on biofuels emissions in October?
Yeah, so we've essentially published a new study very recently. We've been working on biofuels for many years now. We mainly have had like the European perspective on it, as we are based in Brussels. However, recent trends in biofuels and, you know, more of a global push for increasing biofuels production and consumption, we realized that we needed to broaden our scope beyond Europe. So our latest briefing actually looks at biofuel supply and demand and policy drivers from around the world, rather than having just this European focus. So it's kind of a first of its kind study, certainly from our organization.
Just to get us going, what are the major types of biofuels?
So there are several types of biofuels. You can have the more traditional kind, I guess we can call them. So that would be things like ethanol or biodiesel. And these traditional biofuels are already in most fuel stations. So if you go to the fuel pump now, you'll probably see on the nozzle that you're putting in the car, you'll probably see E10 or B7. It depends on what country you're in and what blending mandate they have. But essentially, these biofuels are already in our fuels that we're putting into our cars, into our fuel tanks. So these would be the majority of the biofuels at the moment. But now we're starting to see newer kinds, and we're starting to hear a lot more of these, and there's more marketing campaigns around newer biofuels. So these would be things like HEFA, which would be used for sustainable aviation fuel, or HVO, which is hydro-treated vegetable oil. And these are becoming more and more marketed as sustainable fuels and decarbonization pathways for our transport sector.
Every week, it seems there's a shiny new announcement about biofuels. In just one example, the Norwegian cruise ship Hurtigruten will run a climate-neutral biofuel cruise using hydro-treated vegetable oil. Are these ventures worthwhile, or is it just green window dressing while we continue to burn more fossil fuels?
It's an excellent question. I don't think it's within the environment's benefit to still run cruises. First of all, I can say that. There's a host of problems beyond just the fuel usage that goes with cruises as a mode of tourism. But to address your question, are these ventures worthwhile or just green window dressing or greenwashing, I assume is the term that you're kind of leaning into there. It's important to kind of distinguish that some biofuels can indeed reduce emissions. So I wouldn't say that all biofuel usage is completely greenwashing for the moment. We've shown that in our study. You know, there are some GHG emission reductions depending on the pathway of the biofuel and the feedstock used. However, it's very important to recognize that there's many nuances to it. And one of the problems is that biofuels are very inefficient. So, for example, most of the biofuels these days are still used in road transport. So for road transport, electrification and electric cars that are powered from renewable electricity is a far more sustainable and a far more efficient way of reducing our carbon emissions. But then when we have more hard-to-abate sectors, so things like shipping and like aviation, electrification isn't really an option. And it's within these kind of sectors that biofuels are really being presented as the viable option. However, unfortunately, much of the problems with biofuels in these sectors is the issue of scalability. So truly sustainable biofuels are quite limited in quantity. At TNE, we are adamant that first generation, so crops that are made from food, and that biofuels that are made from food and feed crops should no longer be considered renewable, and they should be phased out of renewable energy targets for transport. truly sustainable biofuels, they are limited in quantity. So I don't really consider them as a viable option for full decarbonization. However, at the moment with markets, they are kind of being presented as the only option. The renewable e-fuels market is still within its infancy, and there's a few years to go until they become a pathway for hard-to-abate sectors.
In 2008, Timothy Sertinger released the study Use of U.S. Croplands for Biofuels Increases Greenhouse Gases Through Emissions from Land Use Change. Now, the biofuel lobby trashed it. They complained about indirect land use change impacts of biofuels, known as ILUC. What is indirect land use change, and why does that matter?
Yeah, so ILUC, indirect land use change, is essentially the crux of the matter when it comes to measuring emissions. This is where a lot of the discussions are and a lot of the controversies are regarding biofuels and policymaking. So due to global markets, competing uses, and there actually just being a limited amount of land to grow biofuels on, we have to consider that indirect emissions that result from the growing demand. So if we dedicate agricultural land use for biofuels, what was previously there, maybe it was cattle or maybe it was another kind of food crop that was there, well, then that needs to be displaced elsewhere. So often at the expense of a high carbon storage land. So the EU actually recognized this. They initially had what we have, the Renewable Energy Directive here. There was this issue that was brought up by Tim Sertinger, and he brought up the issue that, you know, if we start having this increased demand for biofuels, what's going to happen to the global markets and the demand, and how can that seep into further deforestation or land use change indirectly? So the EU recognized this. They brought in a risk-based approach that involves monitoring feedstock expansion over high carbon areas, and that's now being contested in global policymaking.
Your new briefing before COP30 is based partly on a 2024 report called Diverted Harvest: Environmental Risk from Growth in International Biofuel Demand. How does your group and those authors narrow down the uncertainties of land use changes and emissions?
So our recent study, it takes ILUC into consideration for the GHG emissions, and it does that by connecting land use and markets and using crop yields, prices, demand elasticity, and productivity potential to model scenarios and quantify emissions. It also is quite interesting to see in our study that we've taken into consideration carbon opportunity costs as an alternative approach to ILUC modeling. So first-generation biofuels are being shown to have this to be an inefficient solution, according to our report. And these are kind of the arguments that are often being not considered or being ignored when it comes to global policymaking. And that's what makes our report kind of first of its kind and cutting edge in this as well.
Inflation of food prices is a major issue in the United States and many other countries. Has biofuel production reached a point where fuel crops are competing with food crops? And if not yet, when?
But only for specific crops and places. So not yet across the whole global food system. In the United States and in some regions, biofuel production already is a significant share of the crop supply, and therefore it competes with food and feed uses. Globally, however, biofuels are an important, but not the sole or always the dominant driver of food price pressure. So roughly 90% of global biofuel production relies on food commodities, raising questions as to how the growth of the biofuel market will affect the global food supply. So in 2023, the biofuel industry consumed around 150 million tons of corn, 120 million tons of sugar cane and sugar beet. In total, that's the equivalent of 100 million bottles of vegetable oil being burned in our cars every day, meaning a fifth of all vegetable oil supply is not even being used for food. So yes, it certainly does have an impact on food, and we can say that it is competing with food crops.
Humans already use about half of habitable land on this planet for agriculture. If the biofuel boom develops, what about limits? Is there a peak human land use beyond which nature cannot continue, and are biofuels part of that problem?
I don't have a specific figure on these kind of tipping points when it comes to peak human land use and beyond which nature cannot continue. It's not really my expertise when it comes to biodiversity and the kind of outlooks on that. But I will say that biofuels are certainly part of that when we consider the amount of land that is needed to produce energy. So the example that we gave in our report is that for only 3% of the same amount of land used for biofuels, you can produce the same level of energy from solar power. So yeah, if we continue to ramp up our usage of biofuels, and that will increase pressure on land, and it could well contribute to this kind of peak human land use that you referred to.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Kian Delaney from the European NGO T&E. We are talking about whether biofuels deliver lower emissions as promised. The EU and United Kingdom say they will ramp up cellulosic biofuels. What is that? What is the plan? And is this better than other options like burning primary crops?
Cellulosic biofuels, yeah, these are generally made from things like agricultural waste. So the EU and the UK incentivize these types of advanced fuels through mechanisms like double counting is one that we use here in the EU. Now, there's an argument to say that these biofuels are better than first-generation crops. However, there's an absence of the implementation of strong criteria to ensure that crop residue harvests do not exceed what is needed to create and maintain soil health. Other things like agricultural residues, a lot of them already have a use. So if we start using these agricultural residues for biofuels, we may end up with their previous uses turning to more unsustainable options. Maybe that's palm oil or something that already has a worse impact on the environment. So there is some use there for things like cellulosic biofuels. But again, we need to be very careful that we don't kind of put all our eggs in one basket when it comes to these, because there are risks attached to them as well.
The soy trade has soared into international news since China stopped purchasing U.S. soy, at least until a trade deal. You and T&E battled to keep the European Union from accepting biofuels from soy and palm oil as green alternatives to fossil fuels. Why?
Well, palm and soy have the highest GHG emissions when ILUC is accounted for. Both of these crops have a long history of being associated with deforestation, especially in tropical environments, so South America and Southeast Asia, for example. The EU recognized this. When the EU first brought in its biofuel policy, palm oil was accepted, and then we saw this huge rush, this huge glut of palm oil entering into the EU to be turned into biofuels. And at the same time that this was happening, we started to see these devastating images of slash and burn and deforestation in Southeast Asia and displaced orangutans and biodiversity really suffering because of this demand for the oil. So the EU, to try and overturn this, they brought in what is known as the High ILUC Delegated Act. And it's through this Delegated Act that the palm oil was no longer recognized as renewable. It was going to be phased out by 2030. And many countries in Europe have already taken a head start and already said that they will no longer recognize palm oil as renewable. We want the same to happen for soy as well. Soy is actually the second highest, just after palm oil. You have soy when it comes to the risk of high ILUC. We would like to see this Delegated Act revised. It was supposed to be revised in 2023. It was supposed to be revised based on a report that was supposed to be finished in 2021. Neither the report has been published nor the Delegated Act has been revised. And that is why we push for the revision of this Delegated Act so that we can actually see soy recognized on the same level as palm oil as no longer renewable.
T&E is over 30 years old. Your NGO won significant victories like the EU ending the sales of new combustion engine cars and vans by 2035. Are you concerned about the growth of more right-wing politics in the EU and possibly a rollback of campaigns already won?
Yes, this is a major concern at the EU at the moment. We've seen a significant growth in right-wing politics in the European Parliament. and in national governments across the EU. We had what was known as the Green Wave under the previous commission. We still have the same commission president, Ursula von der Leyen, who brought in this Green Wave, part of which was the Green Deal. But now this is under attack. We are starting to see the prioritization of other things, economic interests and defense, rather than environmental and climate issues. And this is a big concern. So at the moment, we're seeing the 2035 CO2 regulation, which is essentially the 2035 internal combustion engine phase-out. We're seeing that being attacked by car manufacturers in Europe who say that this is detrimental to their industry and being supported by right-wing politics. So it's a major concern. It's a time for defending what we had. We had very progressive EU policy that was going to be effective. It's still in place, so nothing has changed as of now. Yet we need to make sure that the previous progress that was made, that we don't have a backslide in the current political context here.
Well, I realize the U.S. is not your focus, but have you heard of any movement by the Trump administration to boost biofuel production or weaken rulings about its total emissions?
I believe as part of the big, beautiful bill, the tax credits for biofuels that were produced in the U.S. were allowed to remain. I'm not sure if they're to the same level, but I believe that there is still some hope there for U.S. biofuel producers. And what is quite concerning is I believe that there's also consideration for removing any reference to ILUC in U.S. policy regarding biofuels.
Also abroad in 2023, India launched the Global Biofuels Alliance to increase global use of biofuels. The alliance now counts 32 member countries, but I'm puzzled. Why are some of the largest fossil fuel producers, like the United States, Canada, and the United Arab Emirates, part of this alliance when it hopes to displace some of their products?
Well, there's a saying in the biofuels world, more the activist side of things, that biofuels are not here to save the planet, they're here to save the fossil fuel industry. And that might seem as a bit counterproductive, but we have to remember that today the majority of biofuels are still blended with fossil fuels. So when you go to the fuel station, when you go to the nozzle, it's going to be, if you're using diesel, it'll still be 93% fossil diesel, 7% biodiesel. So the idea that these will be directly competing with each other, it's not exactly true. You know, fossil fuel producers would rather be in the driving seat of the production of biofuels, because it also means that internal combustion engines and their own fossil fuel products will still stay relevant, as opposed to if we start replacing those things with hydrogen or with electrification. So climate policy will still dictate a need for renewables, and biofuels offer fossil fuel companies a chance to ensure that renewable energy is still going to be achieved through combustion.
And they can call it green and put it in green pumps for us. Oh, well. So tell us about the role of increasing biofuel production in Brazil and destruction of the Amazon rainforest.
Brazil is the second largest producer of biofuels in the world. They're an absolute powerhouse when it comes to biofuels. Sugarcane ethanol and soy biodiesel are two of their key commodities. Soy, in particular, is and has been a major driver of deforestation in Brazil. Things in the Amazon have improved considerably under Lula compared to his predecessor, Bolsonaro. But there is still a cause for concern. So just this year, the Brazilian Ministry for Trade suspended the soy moratorium, which was in place to protect the Amazon from deforestation from soy. And then at the same time, just ahead of the Brazilian COP presidency, Brazil has launched a bid to quadruple sustainable fuels by 2035, which is enormous. Now, as part of this quadrupling, they envision doubling the global supply of biofuels. They've based this on a report from the International Energy Agency, the IEA, and hidden in the small print of this report, it does say that this doubling of biofuels should not come with more land expansion. Very small in the fine print. But as part of this pledge that they're launching to quadruple, we don't see this level of detail regarding land expansion. Furthermore, while deforestation in the Amazon may have decreased recently, there are other biomes in Brazil and in South America that are carbon sinks, so the likes of the Cerrado, which is a kind of grassland. We have also still seen soy expansion in the Cerrado. So it is still a concern. If the advice from IEA is that doubling biofuels is possible with no land expansion. We'd really like to see that in any pledge from Brazil or in any plans from Brazil or any of the countries that sign on to this pledge. We'd like to see some sort of infrastructure or monitoring kind of at the forefront of how we're going to do this. Otherwise, we risk having a very ambitious target of doubling biofuels and with no proper safeguards to make sure that doesn't result in land expansion, or then we could see a considerable amount of land use change, whether it's direct or indirect.
In your experience, who is ready to accept the true carbon cost of biofuels, and who will be on the sort of other side at COP30 to fight off criticism of the industry?
So, T&E will be there at COP, civil society will be there, and we'll be there to make sure that the risks associated with biofuel production are given some attention. There will be, of course, criticism from the industry. We've seen it already, and we've also seen criticism from biofuel producing countries. So recently we had the International Maritime Organization discussing their net zero framework. In the end, these negotiations were postponed due to the US essentially threatening to torpedo the whole initiative. But we do see criticism from the industry and from biofuel producing countries against any pushback against biofuels. We also see collaborations in the forms of what you mentioned previously, the Global Biofuels Alliance and other kind of lobbying associations that are putting industry stakeholders in touch with national governments. And when I say industry stakeholders, it's usually kind of the usual suspects. So we see companies like Shell and Eni and Repsol, so these big fossil fuel companies and energy suppliers who are behind this push for biofuels.
Do you think our love affair with biofuels is based on good intentions, or is it really another industrial solution similar to what got us into this emissions trap?
We have explicitly given a subchapter in our briefing recommending world leaders do not fall into the biofuels trap. I do think that much of our love affair with biofuels is based on good intentions. They're being offered as a ready-made, mature technology to decarbonize our transport sector. However, I do think that there is a need for recognizing and for presenting that the risks that are involved with this. Whether there's nefarious industry lobbying going on, I'm sure there is, and I know there is, and a push for bioenergy as this golden solution. Maybe they're being ill-informed, policymakers can be ill-informed on this, and that they are being used as this get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to decarbonizing transport, rather than investing in other pathways like pure electrification for battery vehicles or for renewable hydrogen for e-fuels. Biofuels are presented as this mature industry. And you can see why a policymaker would consider this as a way or set a target for biofuels for their decarbonization efforts. You know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions, so I wouldn't say that it's all based on bad intentions, but certainly ill-informed intentions.
Well, based on your report, how much extra carbon is produced by some biofuels, more than what would have happened if people had just burned fossil fuels for the same job?
So our report has taken, as I mentioned, it's taken ILUC into consideration for calculating GHG emissions. We've taken the average, so we haven't just looked at biofuels as one. We have to consider the global market when it comes to biofuels. That's the kind of key issue here, because everything is connected now. So while biofuels in one country might show that there are some GHG or emissions reductions, albeit much less than electrification, you have to consider that they're also in the same market as things like palm oil from Indonesia and Malaysia. And that's where we see this massive increase in GHG emissions because of indirect land use change. We've calculated that on average, biofuel usage emits 16% more carbon than the fossil fuels that they're supposed to replace. However, you have to really consider this as a global average. And when there is emissions reductions in certain scenarios, they are very limited compared to other options. And then as well as this, when we're talking about biofuels, it's important that we don't just get stuck in the trap of looking at GHG emissions reductions as the be-all and end-all. There's lots of other factors that need to be considered. So things like intensive agriculture and monocultures, fertilizer runoff, water demand from irrigation. we calculated that to run a car on biofuels would require 3,000 litres of water per 100 kilometres travelled, which is, for fresh water, that's an incredible amount of pressure on our fresh water cycle. So these are other considerations we need to take into account when biofuels. We can't just focus only on GHG emissions reductions.
What should we do? Do we limit or ban biofuels? And if so, do we have real alternatives?
So when it comes to biofuels, we really need to make sure that there are strong safeguards in place. These can look like volume caps. So we have a volume cap here in the EU. Food and feed crop biofuels at the EU policy level, there's a 7% cap. That varies country per country, as it's based on what 2019 levels were for that country. So things like volume caps can help. I don't think we're able to ban biofuels. There's an industry there, and there's laws that allow it to exist. So that's not possible. But what we do need is strong safeguards, strong regulations, things like monitoring and evaluation to be more transparent. So supply chain transparency, as well as certification transparency, these can all be improved to make sure that the environmental or climate damage that's done from biofuels is limited. I think that's the best we can kind of hope for at the moment.
From Brussels, we've been speaking with Kian Delaney, his group T&E in Brussels, and Dr. Chris Mallins at Cereology have investigated the full emissions of biofuels, finding them worse than fossil fuels they replace in some instances. Find links to the press briefing and report in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.transportenvironment.org. Kian, thank you for helping us see this bigger picture.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.